Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. I'm always happy to be back here on Monday. We work our way through the drudgery of the weekend to get back to doing what we love doing on Mondays, which is talk about Jesus and his church. Especially happy this Monday, though, and you'll know in a moment why I'm especially happy this Monday. Well, I'll tell you why. We have two great guests. Second hour, our good friend William Albrecht will be here, and it's always great when William is here. And the first hour, we welcome bona fide media superstar Michael Knowles. He's our guest this hour. We're going to talk about a series that he did, a video series he did on Pope Pius XII, but he tells me he's willing to talk to you about whatever you'd like to talk about as far as the Catholic faith goes. The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Michael Knowles is the host, and it's a good thing too, of the Michael Knowles Show at the Daily Wire and the book club at PragerU. He's the author of two number one national bestsellers, but that's a little touchy to say author of one of them, but certainly the author of one national bestseller. And as I said, that he's got that new four-part series on Pope Pius XII, The Pope and the Führer, The Secret Vatican Files of World War II. Michael Knowles, thank you for being here with us.
The pleasure is all mine. I can honestly say I'm a longtime listener and first-time caller.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm just such a huge fan of Catholic Answers. I was a cradle Catholic, catechized in the 90s. You know, 90s were a little bit of a loose time for catechesis, though I had some great teachers. And I fell away from the faith at 13, right at my confirmation, actually. And I was away for about a decade or so. And when I was coming back, not just intellectually to believe that God exists, but really coming back into the faith and the church, Catholic Answers was a really invaluable resource for me. So I just love it. I recommend it to my listeners and friends and people who write to me. It's just tremendous.
Oh, you're very generous. Thank you very much for saying that. I think you're a Yale graduate. So here you are at 13. I wonder how much of your falling away from the church was the intellectual challenges that the modern world makes of the church, or was it something else? It seems to me that sometimes we are not in a good position to answer a 13-year-old's question, and we lose them.
Yeah, and you can't answer a 13-year-old's hubris is the real problem.
Yeah. Okay,
so
fair
when
enough.
I was, I was a punk kid who thought he was smarter than he was. And this was the age of the new atheists and Christopher Hitchens with that delightful accent and, Richard Dawkins with his Oxford pedigree. And so I just thought religion was for dumb people. And I fell away. I think some of it did have to do even with weak, liturgy, a kind of effeminate practice of the faith. But it was on me. You know, I was just had hubris. And so, ironically, you mentioned I went to Yale. And not too many people become more conservative and religious when they're at Yale.
Yeah.
But that place has a way of radicalizing some people, at least. And so I became convinced God exists freshman year. And then it was by the end of Yale and my first year afterward that I was convinced Christ is who he says he is and that the church is who she says that she is. And that kicked off a big process of reversion.
Oh, how beautiful. What a beautiful story. Do they have like a Newman Center there or something? Or it just you?
They
just,
did. Not that I availed myself of it very often, but they do. They had a Thomas More Center, which I think I went to once or twice, maybe senior year. They have a wonderful parish, St. Mary's, where the Knights of Columbus, were founded. The headquarters is there in New Haven. But I've really only come to avail myself of those resources when I go back for reunions.
Okay.
And I know there are students who are a little further ahead than I was who were practicing there as students.
Well, I ask in part because the most common prayer request we get here at Catholic Answers is, will you pray for my children who have left the church? And there are tons of parents would like to know, he went to college and didn't lose his faith the first year. He came to faith in God the first year. So give me the secret. How can a parent redo in their child's life what happened in your life?
Well, I think you have to ask yourself why the child fell away in the first place. So for me, you intuited that it was the intellectual challenge of the modern world and pop culture. So then I get to Yale. And I realized that there were a lot of people much smarter than me, many of them atheists, secular. But the smartest people, I noticed, had this funny habit of believing in God.
Oh.
And so my roommate, randomly or providentially assigned freshman year, introduced me to, of all things, the ontological argument for God. And it was actually a version of it done in modal logic. So St. Anselm of Canterbury formulates the ontological argument, which is dismissed, though not wholly rejected, by St. Thomas Aquinas. Then it's redone by Gödel and Leibniz and a Calvinist who was at a Catholic university, Alvin Plantinga, did a modal logic version that convinced me. I said, oh, wow. But even more than – so look, the argument itself I think is sound. I agree with Bertrand Russell on that. And I don't think Aquinas really rejects it exactly, you know, though I understand his problems with it. Frankly, even more than the argument, the realization that smart people believed in God was a bigger part for me. And then that led me to read C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, Owen Barfield, you know, lots of other, Hilaire Belloc, wonderful because Belloc is more acerbic and kind of more entertaining in that way. But it led me to read some of those writers. And then I thought, oh, I probably ought to get around to reading the Bible. That would be an interesting thing to do. And, you know, some of the church fathers and doctors of the church. So look, that worked for me because of the problem that I had. Other people have problems that are more emotional with the church, or I mentioned earlier, liturgical. You know, I'm a great fan of reverent liturgy, especially the traditional Latin Mass. I think for some people who didn't like the felt banners of the 90s and felt that it was irreverent or that there were liturgical abuses, I think liturgy is a way to reenchant people with the church, and other ways as well. You know, so even just people have a problem with certain priests, you know, or they have to get over problems with family members. So I don't think there's a one size fits all solution. But to your point, the modern world does present an intellectual challenge to the faith. I think that is waning actually in the last 5 or 10 years. But if that's your problem, then definitely a stack of Chesterton and Lewis and Belloc and those guys are a good way back in.
Well, when we choose the faith, in some ways we are also choosing our group. We're choosing a whole collection of people. And I say this to bring us back to your work on Pius the 12th, because one of the you know, like if you think if Hitchens can convince you that, look, people who believe in God are dumb, you don't want to be one of the dumb people, so you won't join that group. If people can convince you that the Catholic Church is just morally cowardly and hypocritical, you're not going to want to join that group. And it seems to me that that is part of the story of Pius the 12th is he's presented to the world as this man who failed the greatest moral test of the 20th century. Is that who he was?
Oh, it's a complete lie, you know, and Pius really suffered a kind of a white martyrdom. And he did so out of moral courage, but it's just nonsense. And I guess the proof of that is that a lot of the historical revision comes about decades later. You know, it really begins with a work of fiction, actually, a play in the 1960s that then was built upon by historical revisionists in the 1990s. In fact, that fiction was promoted literally by the KGB and communist agents. Right. And then, but really, the fight over state,
right?
The deputy was the play.
The play was the deputy, yeah.
The play was never put on in its entirety because the play was 8 hours long. It was total fiction. I mean, no honest person could say it was actually advancing historical fact. And it was a rant, but it was seized upon by enemies of the church to promote this calumny. I remember encountering that book, Hitler's Pope, in the late 90s, I guess. But again, it's a lot of nonsense that is refuted not only by the documents, some of which have come out since from the Vatican, but even by Hitler's own words. You know, Hitler wrote a letter to Francisco Franco and said that he considered Pius XII his personal enemy. There's a lot of good evidence that Hitler was planning to, at the very least, kidnap and probably execute the Pope, not the sort of thing you do to your friend. And also, there's the historical fact that Pius was basically the last guy standing in Rome. So after the King of Italy had fled, after Mussolini had left, there was Pius standing alone to say, I will not surrender the Holy See, and I will not surrender Rome to the Nazis. And I guess one final bit, though, you know, one could speak for hours and hours in defense of Pius. But here's one final proof. At the end of the war, the chief rabbi of Rome, Israel Zoli, converted to Catholicism. Not only did he convert to Catholicism, which would be a strange thing to do if the Catholic Church had abandoned the Jewish people during this great moral test. Not only did he do that, he took the name Eugene, Eugenio, which is Pius XII's Christian name, to be his name when he was baptized. So this is a man who held Pius XII in great esteem, as should we all, because he was, not only did he not do anything wrong or fail any moral tests, he was an exemplar of moral courage during the Second World War, as he was for his career.
Michael Knowles is our guest. He's the host of the Michael Knowles Show at the Daily Wire. And if you have questions for Michael, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. You want to talk about Pope Pius XII? You want to talk about the Catholic faith more generally? You are welcome here. 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. I invite you to listen to Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. On Catechism in a Year, you'll encounter God's plan of sheer goodness for us. Throughout the year, we read through the Catechism of the Catholic Church with direct quotes, plus time for explanations and reflections. I hope you can join us every day or as often as you can.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. If you were asking yourself, I wonder if Catholic Answers Live has made the big time yet. Yeah, we made the big time. Michael Knowles is here with us today. 888-318-7884 is the number. And we were delighted to find that Michael had done a four-part series on Pope Pius XII, who you will not be surprised to learn we agree with him is much maligned, a tremendous unfairness. The Pope and the Führer, the secret Vatican files of World War II, is available now at the Daily Wire. You can check it out there. You start one of the videos with kind of evoking the fake news of our day, and I think the way you kind of say it, I won't be able to quote it, but nobody got more fake newsed than Pius XII. He got the ultimate fake news treatment.
Yes. Yeah, it was just awful. It's one of the worst historical calumnies I've ever seen, certainly in recent memory. And I think what a lot of it was about, because as we mentioned in the earlier block, everyone agreed that Pius was a moral and courageous man during the war. Everyone agreed shortly after the war that Pius XII was a moral and courageous man. The calumny against him really didn't begin until a decade and a half later, just about. And so that has to raise your suspicions, not just on the fake news and these kinds of fights, but what the fight is really about. And I think a lot of the battle over the legacy of Pius XII was, one, a battle waged by the enemies of the church, promoted by the KGB, for instance, but also it was a little bit of an intra-Catholic fight. Oh. The fact that it kicked off in the 1960s, I think, is no coincidence. As there were debates over the future of the church, what the church would look like in the wake of the Second Vatican Council and all of the reforms that followed, you know, there were figures who were trying to argue that we really ought to ignore church history and church tradition, who were looking forward to a new springtime for the church. And, you know, one of the stubborn figures for them, I think, was Pope Pius XII, who was this figure of humility, of courage, of care, of selflessness, but also who was a figure of tradition. And so I do wonder if part of the promotion of these historically nonsense calumnies against Pius XII, easily refuted as we do in the Daily Wire series, I wonder if part of that was a little bit of a civil war within the church for the not the past of the church, but what the future of the church would look like.
I had not thought of that, Michael. That's an excellent point. So I do think, though, there's a kind of an easy case to make against Pius XII, which is we don't have any film of him ever coming out on the loggia there and condemning Adolf Hitler, calling this whole thing racist, saying that what he did know, in fact, which was Jews are being murdered by the thousands in Poland and in Germany. He didn't do it. We don't have the video of him saying that. We don't have the film of him saying that, which is the kind of, I think many people to take as a proof that he was a moral coward.
Yes. Well, the easiest answer to that is, what happened when the Dutch bishops spoke out? The Dutch bishops did speak out in a very public and I would even say flamboyant way against the Nazis. And it's all well and good. I'm sure it felt very cathartic. But what happened as a result of that? Many, many Jews were slaughtered. And Pius XII, and we now can know this actually from the historical record, realized that if he were to do the same thing, it might provide some good PR for him. The result would be for him as the Pope, a million Jews could be slaughtered. We know that he was working behind the scenes to protect the Jews of Rome and did save many. And we know, actually, because of his leadership and the care of the church, many hundreds of thousands of Jews were saved. Something like 800,000 Jews were saved during the Second World War. We know that the ones in his immediate vicinity, he was intervening on their behalf and establishing ways for them to get out of Europe and documents for them to leave. We know that he was hiding them in Castel Gandolfo and other places. We know that before he ascended to the seat of Peter, when he was the papal nuncio, the Secretary of State, he was working with Pope Pius XI. On Mitbrunnendo Sorga, on plenty of other, papal letters to get out in the vernacular to try to stem the tide of Nazism. But the question would become, what would be better for him to do? To make a big show for himself, even if it meant that many Jews would be killed, or to work behind the scenes and suffer a kind of white martyrdom? And I know what the Christian thing to do is, and it happens to be what he did, and it resulted in much greater good.
Again, the number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Michael, if you're up for it, I'll go to the phones and we'll take some calls.
That'd be great. I'd love it.
Michael Knowles from the Daily Wire, our guest. Off to the phones we go. We start in Denver, Colorado. Taylor in Denver, Colorado, watching on YouTube. Welcome, Taylor. You got a question for Michael?
Yes. Hi, Michael. I'm a big fan of your show, Michael. I watched you all throughout the election last year. I talked about you so much, though, that my husband and toddler know who you are.
I'm honored. Thank you.
But the marriage is still solid, though. It didn't get in the way of that. It wasn't so much that it destroyed the marriage, Taylor.
No. When I say, like, well, I was watching Michael Knowles, my husband just go, okay, what did he say today? But so you actually touched on my original question about the debate around Pope Pius XII. So I wanted to ask, how does this debate inform how religious leaders should act in our modern humanitarian crises or genocides?
Oh, yes. Well, obviously, the church has a role to play in the affairs of the world. I know that there's an inclination in modernity to say that the church should just be this kind of ethereal thing and not touch on anything mucky or yucky like politics. But that has not been how the church has worked going back to antiquity. And obviously the church and the papacy have had a role in politics all from antiquity throughout the Middle Ages, relying in some cases on the protection of secular kings and shedding spiritual light on those kings to grow the civilization that we know as Christendom. So there is a distinction to be made between the spiritual and the temporal, but the church should not stay quiet on temporal matters. On the flip side, we have to remember that the church has competency, in particular competency, in certain areas that she might not have in others. So if the church is going to weigh in on some particular, I don't know, environmental policy or something, that is to be taken with less gravity than, say, the church weighing in on a matter of dogma or doctrine. And this, you know, is all rather nuanced, and frankly, it's more an art than a science. But the church has never taught the kind of quietism that I think a lot of secular leaders would prefer, which is for the church to just shut up and go her own way and keep quiet while, you know, political leaders, for instance, imprison nuns and pro-life advocates. Can't do that. You know, that's not the role in the world. The church has to have an active stance. As a priest friend of mine once pointed out, there are too many pacifists in the church militant. And when our Lord tells us that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church, he is obviously not describing a defensive posture of the church. He's not saying that the armies of hell will not prevail against the church. He's saying that the gates of hell will not prevail, meaning that the church will be active and will knock down the gates of hell and will be on the move in the world.
Okay, Taylor.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it kind of makes me think about, like, Pope Leo and the Vatican having to deal with China right now as well.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what
I was
thinking of. But, yeah, I totally agree. Gates of hell will not prevail. Thank you so much.
Well, Taylor, I'm really glad to hear your toddler knows who Michael Knowles is, too. That's a healthy family that you've got going there. Thanks, Taylor.
He knows who you are, too,
Si. Oh, sure. Oh, you don't need to throw that in at the end, Taylor. Come on now.
I watch Catholic Answers, like, every day. I'm listening to you guys all the time. So my whole family knows I call in.
Okay, that's
it. They're actually asking.
Give her a free book.
Stop.
Find a free book and give. Okay, Taylor, we're going to send you a free book. Hang on. Just give us an address. We'll send it to you there in Denver. Thanks for getting us started, Taylor, with the calls. Two lines open right now, 888-318-7884, the number. Michael Knowles, our guest, has a video, a four-part video series out now about Pope Pius XII. Was he Hitler's pope? Yeah, there's actually a book that describes him, a quite popular book that describes him as Hitler's pope. Is that the truth? You can find out by watching that video series and or just give a call here and talk with Michael yourself, 888-318-7884. Going to Cary, Illinois, where Lucas is watching on YouTube. Lucas, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. Hi. How are you guys doing?
Very well. Thank you, Lucas.
Good, good. I really like you. I really like Catholic Dancers. I really like Michael Knowles. He's a great apologist, and I hope he gets into his Catholic faith even more than he has been recently. My question is, so there is clearly a lot of bad things going on in Gaza. Two popes, Pope Leo the 14th and Pope Francis the 1st, have both maintained that there are bad things going on there and that they have maintained contacts there. And so how would one reconcile that with Mr. Knowles, especially your relationship with the defense of Israel? How do we reconcile that as Catholics when the state of Israel is bombing Catholics? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lucas.
That's a great question. Well, you know, I've long said that I have the least popular view of all on the conflict in Israel and Gaza, which is that I think that it's roughly intractable. And I think that by the standards of international law, the state of Israel exists as a legitimate nation, but also that we have to protect the legitimate rights of the Palestinians in Gaza. So I can promise you from the perspective of politics, that's a great way to get both sides absolutely hating you, which is, by the way, why I think my position happens to be correct. And so as Christians, we have a particular interest in protecting Christians in the Holy Land who have been there for 2,000 years and who still exist, though, in a very small number in Gaza. Unfortunately, Islam has really crowded out Christianity there. And also, we need to protect the Christian presence in the holy sites. What does that mean? What do we do about it? Well, if the two options that are being presented by the partisans are that we obliterate, the Palestinians, I think that would probably be unacceptable by the standards of just war, just conduct in war. But if the other alternative is that we wipe out the nation state of Israel, by what mechanism you would do that in international law, I don't know. If it's by the mechanism advanced by Hamas, which is through genocide, I think that would probably be unjust and unacceptable. So then what are we left to do? And I think... without getting too party political, I think President Trump's plan was pretty good, you know, and I think the way he was able to do it was by restraining the ambitions of some within the Israeli government, some of whom wanted to remove the Palestinians from Gaza entirely, send them to a place like South Sudan or something, but also by being tough and really curtailing the Islamists in Gaza. And so the plan seems to be working relatively well for an extremely hostile region. I agree. I was deeply troubled by the attacks, albeit perhaps accidental, on Holy Family and on St. Porphyrius. I don't see how it's in the interest of the state of Israel to attack Christian communities there. I take them at their word that those were accidental, but then there need to be fewer accidents, especially when that country has the backing of the United States. And I think what we have to pray for is peace, you know, and I know that it doesn't give one the kind of vitriolic and visceral, ideological glee of saying, well, you know, here's one pat simple solution for eternity. But there will not be peace permanently in Jerusalem this side of the second coming. You know, that's just a fact of politics. And so if both parties have failed in Gaza, but President Trump is able to bring about something at least resembling peace, I think that would advance the interests of the church and of justice broadly.
Lucas, again, thank you very much for the call and for the question. I'm still looking at two lines open, which is actually shocking me. If you would like to talk with Michael Knowles about his series on Pope Pius XII, if you've got questions about Pope Pius as a was he a morally cowardly person, a collaborator, or a hero, your questions welcome. 888-31-TRUTH.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
What is the Catholic Church? Everyone seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I don't know if you're super savvy about where to go for these things on the internet or not savvy at all, but if you want to watch Michael Knowles' four-part series, The Pope and the Führer, The Secret Vatican Files of World War II, just go to the Daily Wire and you can watch it there. And a very welcome. You know, one thing we were talking about here in the office a little bit before was that Pope Francis opened up the archives completely to Pius's full pontificate. I think it was 2020 or 2022.
It was quite recent.
Yeah. So, and then after that happened, no news reports of any significance. So we're all going, it must not be bad for Pius because there's no reporting. Like if there was even a single letter in there that said, I don't know, I'm kind of soft on this guy, Hitler, or, you know, whatever, that gave the wrong impression, we'd have heard about it loud and clear. And you just are not hearing it.
You know, Pope Pius XII, and we have good historical support for this, performed a long-distance exorcism on Hitler because he thought he was possessed by the devil. Now, long-distance exorcisms are, you know, kind of a shot in the dark. That's not generally how those things are done. But he was quite convinced of that. So that's not exactly the language of Hitler's pope. We also know that Pope Pius XII had a letter renouncing the papacy in his desk drawer because there was a plot to abduct the pope and potentially to execute him. And so he had the renunciation letter in there so that if the Nazis did in fact abduct him, they would only have a priest on their hands, I guess a bishop, but they would not have the Pope, and then a new conclave would take place to elect a Pope. So there was plan A, B, and C in store. They have nothing, the revisionists, to really hold on him.
That conclave would have probably had to have been in New York City. I mean, given the condition of the world, how many places could you hold? I was going to say South America, but I don't know if you could have had it in South America. Again, 888-318-7884, the number. All right, back to the phones we go. We're very excited to have Michael Knowles here with us, and I want as many as can to talk with him. Paul is in Minnesota watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Paul. Oops, did I push the wrong? Paul, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question.
Howdy. I was just wondering how to meditate on the rosary, especially the last two mysteries. I know that prayer is as much to change our own selves as to change events in the world. And so I always tend to turn towards scripture if I'm ever feeling like I can't think of something. And there's the four senses of scripture. So I gravitate towards the moral sense of like, here's something I can apply to myself. But there's no direct scriptural sort of commentary or articulation, and I have a hard time thinking about these two mysteries.
You're talking about which are you talking about the Ascension of Mary and the Coronation of Mary, or did you
yes,
okay, I didn't know if you said glorious mysteries.
Well,
that's an interesting question for Michael Knowles. Help us meditate on the last two mysteries, the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary into heaven and the Coronation of Mary as the Queen of Heaven.
Oh, happily. I love meditating on those mysteries of the rosary. I guess the way that I would think about it is look, and sometimes I'm distracted and sometimes I'm thinking in a more conscious way of say, a moral question or a problem in my own life. And I find that gets me a little bit stuck in my head. The way that I try to approach the mysteries, and not just the glorious mysteries, but the others as well, is just to see something. So I think Joseph Conrad writes this very well in an introduction to one of his books. He says that the thinker deals in ideas and the scientist deals in facts, but the artist is there to make you see something. And so that's how I try to approach it. I try to approach it in more of a poetic sense, I guess. And so if I'm meditating on the Assumption, I want to see it. You know, I want to see Our Lady being lifted up. I want to, and it's much harder to meditate to really see what's happening in the Assumption than it would be in, say, the Nativity or the Annunciation or something. But I want to see that because I find I've been praying the Rosary for however knows how long. I try to do it every single day. And what's so strange about the Rosary is that you're praying the same three mysteries, so, over and over again. Maybe you add the Luminous and you have a fourth set of mysteries, but that's it. And yet, if you're really praying it in a serious way, you're seeing something new, and you're therefore discovering something new every day. So, with the Assumption of Our Lady, I suppose I think about what's she wearing, what does it look like? It's body, So, what does that mean for our own bodies? We're talking about flesh here. What does it look like when she gets up to heaven? And then that's obviously tied in with the fifth mystery, which is the coronation. Well, what does that mean? What will I see someday? My favorite poem, speaking of poetry, is the Divine Comedy, and I can't get through it in the final canticle of Paradise without crying in those final moments. And Dante's trying to give us a view of what the Trinity looks like. And for him, too, it's so connected through our fleshiness so that he's looking to his love, Beatrice, and he's seeing reflected in her eyes Our Lady. And then Our Lady is looking to our Lord and looking to the Godhead. And so anyway, that's all a kind of poetical and rambling way to say, I try to look at what it means for our flesh, for the colors that we're going to see. And often I'm praying the Rosary as I'm driving, which I probably shouldn't. I should probably be in my room with my eyes closed. But I connect those mysteries for something as ethereal and magnificent as the Assumption and the Coronation with the trees that I'm driving past, with the clouds in the sky that I'm looking at. Because, we're told that we have to be like children to enter into heaven. And so you think it's a child who assumes that when we go to heaven, we're just going to look around the clouds or something. But there's a reason that God has given us this image for the heavens. And so I look at those clouds too, and I think, someday when I... If I'm lucky, hopefully, when I look around there, it is in a meaningful sense going to look like this, and Our Lady is going to be wearing something. in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. And she will have her body in heaven too. And she will really be crowned. And that will mean something as real to me as when a president is inaugurated or a king might be crowned on his throne.
Paul, thank you very much for the question. I know you probably have a pretty good job there, but if you're ever looking for work, Michael, that was a pretty good apologetics answer.
Thank you.
We like that one.
I fear sometimes when I speak about something personal like that, I say, I don't know, maybe I'm getting a little rambly. But for people who pray the rosary every day, I think you probably know what I'm talking about.
Amen. All right, off to Dearborn, Michigan we go now, listening on the Ave Maria Radio Network. Betsy in Dearborn, thanks for the call. Betsy, go ahead with your question for Michael Knowles.
Hi. The question I have is, there is a group of people who tout themselves as the true Catholic Church called Set of Vacantists, and I just recently found out about this. We in Detroit, we have beautiful Catholic churches, and it's also a warning to those who would like to go and think they're going to a Catholic church in Detroit. You got to make sure it's a true Catholic church. So the question is that they recognize Pope Pius XII as the last vicar of Christ. Did he foresee Vatican II? On the horizon, and this whole Set of Vacantists thing, I guess that would have come after him. So, and also, like I said, a warning to people who think they're going to a Catholic church, make sure it's a legit Catholic church.
As opposed to the true Catholic Church, which is not a legit Catholic church. All right.
Yeah.
It's odd, but that's the name of a church that is actually in a state of schism with the Catholic Church. Michael?
Yes, there have been schisms and heresies and all sorts of things since antiquity. So I guess what makes Sede Vacantism a little different than some of the modern stuff we see is that Sede Vacantism is wrapped in the garb of tradition. Just a reminder that schism and heresy can come in all forms, and it doesn't favor just one aesthetic or another. But yes, the claim is that the seat of Peter is empty, sede vacante. I once accidentally went to a sede vacantist church, I guess. I sort of stumbled on one, and I realized something was a little bit up through the liturgy. This was many years ago at this point. But I suppose the reason that I've never been attracted to sede vacantism or groups that are out of communion with the Catholic Church is because it seems to me just like another form of Protestantism. And I don't mean to be so dismissive, because there were a lot of problems that occurred in the middle and latter part of the 20th century, as there have been lots of problems that have occurred throughout the history of the Church. However, it's very important that when we take liturgy seriously, when we take continuity seriously, and the magisterium seriously, we don't want to make an idol out of our own private judgment, you know, and we want to remain obedient and faithful to the Church, because we're promised that the bark of Peter is going to be stormy, and we see figures of this in the Gospels. And however, it's really our only hope, you know, when our Lord says, I have the words of life, and whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has life in them. And if you don't, then you have no life in you. Then the people murmur and they go away. Disciples go away. And he turns to Peter and he says, you haven't gone away. And Peter says, Lord, to whom shall we go? And that's how I feel. And then on another point, because I'm sure in many cases, the Sede Vacantists probably have a more compelling liturgy, at least. Maybe they even have a better homilies than certain actual Catholic parishes that we see. But I look around and I'm reminded of a line from Hilaire Belloc, great Catholic writer of the 20th century, who said that he is bound, he said it more eloquently than I will, but he said that he is bound to take it as a matter of faith that the Catholic Church is divinely instituted. But for those who do doubt the divine institution of the Catholic Church, one proof of that divine institution is that no other organization conducted with such knavish imbecility would have lasted a fortnight. And so I'm continuing to throw my lot in with Rome, no matter the problems that arise.
It's knavish imbecility that did it, Betsy. Thanks very much for the call. Michael Knowles, our guest. We have to take a very quick break, but we're going to come back and try to get everybody on with Michael before we have to go. Right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1996. The World Over debuts with Raymond Arroyo. Each week, Raymond challenges viewers with important political and cultural reporting and analysis of a wide variety of topics of interest to Catholics and people of faith.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back. Next hour, our good friend William Albrecht will be here. This hour, Michael Knowles is our guest from The Michael Knowles Show at The Daily Wire. And he was gracious enough to come on with us. We wanted to talk a bit about his very fine four-part video series he did on Pope Pius XII, and really on rescuing, or towards the goal at least, of rescuing Pius XII from a whole bunch of nastiness that's been said about him that has nothing to do with the actual history of the man or his times. You can check it out on the Daily Wire. But we also said, if you have other questions about the Catholic faith, you're welcome to call and ask them. And folks have taken us up on that. We'll go now to Chris in Lansing, Michigan, also watching on YouTube. Chris, welcome. You got a question for Michael?
Hey, Si. Good to hear from you again.
Oh, nice to hear from you, Chris.
Michael,
Thank you.
Yeah. I was just curious about the canonization process for Pope Pius XII, because I know he was declared venerable by Benedict XVI. Where do we think, maybe in your lifetime or maybe the next generation, do we think he'll be canonized as a saint? And similarly, what are the best writings of his that I could look into that would really teach me about what he believed and where he was as a Catholic man? Thank you.
Oh, good question. I'll take in the opposite order. I mean, I would read the encyclicals. His encyclicals are really good. And I would read his encyclicals and the encyclicals of Pius XI in concert, because obviously one proceeds from the other. And he chose the name Pius XII to show continuity with Pius XI. And he worked very closely with Pius XI because he was basically the right-hand man at the Vatican. He was the Vatican Secretary of State. And before that, he was the Papal Nuncio in Germany. So, you know, he's kind of the singular man of that era. And in terms of the canonization process, I find myself of two minds on it, actually, because, as you say, he's a servant of God and then made Venerable Pius XII. And, you know, it's above my pay grade to canonize people, but it seems like he's as worthy a contender as just about anybody. But of course, there's a real juridical process for that. And we are confused by that fact in modern times, because we seem to fast track popes. You know, everyone just becomes a saint right away. That's historically a little bit weird in the history of the church. And I suspect part of that was because of the tumult that followed the Second Vatican Council. I think there was probably an impulse to canonize the council and some of the to forestall some of the debates that followed the reforms that followed the council themselves. That said, I think we should slow it down. I think it's actually better to allow natural cults, you know, to develop over time and allow this process to play out as the church plays out her history, not in days and weeks, but in centuries. That said, if we're going to fast track all the popes now to canonization, then, you know, if that's the standard, there's no better candidate than Pius XII.
Chris, I'm going to keep going to try to get everybody on. I hope that this habit of canonizing popes is extended to radio hosts before too long. That'll be a good thing when that happens. Todd is in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Welcome, Todd. You got a question for Michael? Oh, he's coming. Hi, Todd. Uh-huh. Oh, he's really far behind. Sometimes we have to wait for the signal to bounce off. How does radio work? It bounces off the sun? I'm not sure exactly.
I think that's it. It bounces off Mars. We need to get Elon in here with Starlink.
Come on, help us out. Todd's going to notice that he's on in just a second. No? Should I? I'll have to come back to you, Todd. It's taking too long. All right.
I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. Gosh, I'm so sorry. It's awful soft. Well, I guess it's as loud as it's going to get. Hey, so the question is that hopefully you guys are familiar. Maybe you've already talked about it. But the movie The Scarlet and the Black, I believe, had Gregory Peck in it, and it was about World War II and Pope Pius and the work that, Gregory Peck as a Monsignor was doing with that. But I was curious, what did you think of the portrayal of Pius, Pope Pius?
Well, tell us how he was portrayed, Todd. Give us an idea. How was Pius portrayed in that movie?
Well, in my humble opinion, I thought that they made it look like he was just walking in absolute razor-thin wire. And he was giving Gregory Peck permission to do whatever you need to do, but don't let me know about it.
To save Jews. Okay, let's let Michael Knowles answer. Thank you, Todd.
Well, I actually haven't seen the movie, but I've never let my ignorance stop me from commenting on something. So I'm happy to weigh in, of course. It gets to a really important point in the calumnies against and the defense of Pope Pius XII, which is to remember his place historically. So the Lateran Treaty has just been concluded. This resolves the Roman question, which began in, 1849. The popes had essentially been prisoners of Rome because the Republicans of Italy stole the Papal States. And so the temporal authority of the popes had been greatly shrunk. This has just been concluded now. There's a fascist takeover of Italy. The entire continent is tearing itself apart. You've now got the United States and Japan entering into the war. Pius is in a politically very difficult spot. He knows that if he speaks out, one, he would imperil the Jews themselves because of what we saw in the Netherlands. But also, he's got these responsibilities. The responsibility is the vicar of Christ on earth for the universal church. His responsibilities to the Urbi et Orbi. You know, he's got responsibilities in Rome, in the Italian peninsula, throughout Europe, and so on. So, yes, he was walking a tightrope. But that said, he was not vacillating morally in any way. I mean, he was morally as clear as can be. This is not just a hagiography. To your point that you made earlier, the fact that the archives have now been fully open for years and there are really no hit pieces that have come out on him, I think really proves that. But it's a reminder, too, that the Pope has political constraints. You know, he is a man in time and history. Ours is an incarnational faith. And to dismiss that somehow, I think, is not only unfair, it's preposterous.
And you know what? I'm going to keep going. I want to get everybody on with Michael Knowles if I can. So I'm just not going back to callers today. But Todd, thank you very much. I'm glad we did get to speak with you. Grace is in Wilmington, North Carolina. Grace, you've been waiting a while. Thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Michael Knowles.
Hey, sir. Hey, sir. Hey, Mr. Knowles.
Hi, Grace.
I want to know, considering the era that Pope Pius lived in, I want to know, what, if any, comments did he have about the third secret of Fatima?
Okay.
And also, what did he think about the fact that Russia was never consecrated to the Immaculate Heart of Mary?
That's a good question. I wish I could be the Pope's spokesman, but I'm really not. I'm wholly ignorant. I've read many theories about the third secret of Fatima. And even the various consecrations of Russia to Mary, which seemed to have taken place, but then maybe didn't take place. And so I wish I could give you a more compelling answer on your very particular question, but I have to shrug my shoulders with, especially vis-a-vis a man who died in the 1950s. And I hope we find out during our sojourn on Earth, but we might have to wait until we're on the other side of the veil.
Grace, hang on. I'd love to send you a book because you waited a while, and I appreciate that very much. But I have a question I'd like to get to Michael. I think it's from the internet. I'm not exactly sure who. I don't have a name next to it. But essentially, the question for you, Michael Knowles, is how do we make the United States Catholic?
Really good question. And I think give it enough time is my simple answer. And it's not just soft soap and wishful thinking, because Alexis de Tocqueville, who's the greatest analyst of American democracy ever, writes in the second volume of Democracy in America, he says, look, it's a Protestant country, but over time it's going to tend in two directions. It's going to either give up religion entirely, because democracies hate having authorities, so they want to give up any authority. But if they maintain a religious authority, they want that authority to be uniform. And the only religion that has a proper universal uniformity to it is the Catholic Church. And so America will give up religion entirely or will move to the Church of Rome, is Tocqueville's words. And I think a lot of people would have laughed at this until recently, because you're now seeing a big uptick in Catholicism, especially in the United States, not merely because of mass migration, but because of adult conversions. And you're seeing this throughout the West. You're seeing this in France as well. I'm not terribly surprised to see it, because I think, you know, it's the true church and will survive all of the schisms and the heresies. But another reminder, too, that even our political order, established by pilgrims and Puritans and separatists and Protestants, not too many Catholics among them, if you look at the political order of the United States as it's outlined in the Constitution, and you read St. Thomas Aquinas on the ideal regime and the Summa Theologiae, it's actually kind of hard to find much distinction between the two. And so we might have more of a Catholic country than we think, even just below the surface already.
Do you have in your mind things that we can do to help bring that about? I mean, I know there are people who say, well, just live a good example. But I feel like there's more that we could do than that.
Yes. Well, prayer is good. You know, prayer, as a priest friend of mine, Father Ben Keeley, points out, is really the first resort. It's not supposed to be the last resort. But then we have to remember that religion is lived out. You know, it's a public thing. It's not just, as some politicians want us to believe, something that we do when we close our eyes in our own heads. You know, we have to, religion is a habit of virtue that inclines the will to give to God what he deserves. So you got to do that in public, where two or more are gathered. You know, that's where our Lord is also. So, you know, you have to do that in community. And sacramental theology, I think, is very attractive to people, especially today, for this reason. We live so much of our lives virtually online, where the body doesn't matter. People are drawn to the alternative. So we need to promote that sort of thing. We have to have the clarity of vision and the moral courage to actually live our life in a public way. And we need to insist upon standards and norms that are properly Catholic. You know, that is conducive to everyone's flourishing. And we need to stop buying the nonsense fed to us by late 20th century politicians who want to pretend that the American political order is supposed to exclude religion. That is not true today. That never has been true. And the very fact that our country is much more open to Catholicism than it has, we have a practicing Catholic vice president, for instance, something that most people would have thought was not imaginable. We can continue to promote that. And the secularists and the atheists can whine and scream, but the actual American political tradition, I think, is on our side. We just have to have the courage to follow it.
I imagine you must get it all the time, though, that when even the question that I asked you, there are people who will go, well, see that? They want a theocracy. They want it to be a Catholic country.
Well, you know, theocracy has a real definition, though people abuse that term. You know, theocracy is ruled by religious clerics. And I don't think, you know, we do have an American citizen who is a monarch of a country. That would be Pope Leo. You know, he is an American who happens to be a monarch. But he went to Rome to do that. He didn't stay here in America. So no one's asking for rule by clerics. There are plenty of clerics I wouldn't want anywhere near political power in the United States. What we're acknowledging is that all polities have some relation to morality and to religion. It's just inescapable. You know, if you're going to pass a law, forget about abortion or the death penalty, say. If you're going to pass a law about parking tickets or speeding, you're going to have recourse to some moral reasoning. So what the secularists say is, well, we just don't want you to have recourse to Christian moral reasoning. We want to have recourse to New Age moral reasoning or utilitarian moral reasoning or deontological. But, you know, that's just rigging the game. It's totally preposterous. And for most of our country's history, we did, in fact, have recourse to substantially Christian moral reasoning. And it worked a lot better than it does today.
Michael Knowles has been our guest. Everything that we hoped for. Thank you so much, Michael. It's just been a delight to have you on for the hour. Thank you.
Well, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
I hope people will check out Michael's four-part video series. Well, you can always check the Michael Knowles Show out on the Daily Wire. But he's got this four-part series that I think you will find quite bracing and helpful in keeping your confidence when people say Pope Pius XII was one of the great moral cowards of the 20th century. As Michael himself said, nothing could be further from the truth. Check out that video series on the Daily Wire, The Pope and the Führer, the Secret Vatican Files and of World War II. All right, coming up, why aren't you Catholic? That's what we're going to ask you. Our good friend William Albrecht will be here. And if you're not a Catholic, we're holding the lines open for you. 888-318-7884.